3, 2, 1, liftoff.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Welcome to a History of the Space Race podcast, episode 75, Salyut 1. In 1971, while the Apollo program was entering maturity and turning increasingly towards scientific exploration with Apollo 14 and Apollo 15, the Soviet Union was focused on implementing its own plans to launch and operate the first space station. As I mentioned back in episode 63 on the Soviet cover-up, after NASA succeeded in the first manned lunar orbital flight with Apollo 8 in December 1968, the Soviet Union began to emphasize the construction of an Earth orbital space station as a significant accomplishment to divert attention away from NASA's manned moon landing program. Less than a year later, in October 1969, Leonid Brezhnev firmly identified the launch of a space station as the Soviet Union's next major goal. The Soviet Union managed to accomplish that goal just 18 months later, on April 19th, 1971, with the launch of Salyut 1. The Soviet Union had managed to launch a space station on a fairly compressed timeline by cutting a few corners and taking advantage of prior work done by Sergei Korolev and Vladimir Chelemy. Korolev had had plans for a space station called Zvezda in the early 1960s. The information on this Zvezda is a bit scarce, particularly as today there is a module of the International Space Station called Zvezda, so any search for information about Korolev's Zvezda will call up information about the ISS module. Korolev's Zvezda never got very far. It never received official sanction or funding. And with Korolev focused on Vostok, and then Soyuz, and then Vashod, and then the N1L3 program, Korolev never devoted much attention to the space station program. One of Korolev's rivals, Vladimir Chelemy, on the other hand, expended far more resources on the development of a Soviet space station. This was likely because Chelemy, unlike Korolev, didn't have a significant number of manned space programs consuming his time and resources. Chelemy had only briefly had control over the manned circumlunar flight program with the LK-1 before Korolev convinced the Soviet government to give that program back to him as part of Soyuz. As a result, Chelemy had more resources to expend on development of an Earth orbital space station, the one area of manned spaceflight that Korolev was not spending much time on. Chelemy's space station proposal was called Almaz. The Almaz is rather unique in terms of manned spaceflight programs that I have discussed on this podcast. Unlike Mercury, Gemini, Apollo, Vostok, Soyuz, Vashod, and the other manned programs I have discussed so far, the Almaz was developed primarily for military purposes. The Soviet Union had backed Chelemy's development of the Almaz in response to the United States researching its own military space station, the Manned Orbital Laboratory, which was a U.S. Air Force program. By 1969, when Brezhnev made a space station the next focus for the Soviet Union in space, Chelemy had made considerable progress on the Almaz. He had overseen the construction of 8 test stand models, as well as 2 models of the space station that were flight-worthy. There was, however, a still significant amount of work to be done before an Almaz could be launched. Although significant progress had been made on the spacecraft, little progress had been made on spacecraft instrumentation. The Almaz was lacking systems for control, guidance, and power. The earliest that the Almaz could have been launched was probably sometime in early 1972. That was not fast enough for Soviet leadership. To speed up the launch of a Soviet space station, Dmitry Ustinov came up with a new plan. Now, it's been a while since I've mentioned Ustinov, but there are three important things to note about Ustinov. First, by this time, Ustinov is the secretary of the Central Committee for Defense Industries and Space. Basically, he was the most senior ranking official in the Soviet government with direct oversight of the space programs. The second thing to know is that Ustinov hated Chelmy. If you'll recall back in episode 38, I discussed how the fall of Nikita Khrushchev had led to the breakup of Chelmy's control over many industries that had allowed him to accumulate influence over developments in the Soviet space program. Much of that breakup had been orchestrated by Ustinov, who was promoted to Secretary of the Central Committee for Defense and Space Industries after Khrushchev was removed from power. The third thing to note about Ustinov is that the failures in the Soviet space program and the success of the Apollo program had made him somewhat politically vulnerable. Since he was the highest-ranking government official overseeing the Soviet space programs, the buck ultimately stopped with him. It was for this reason that he likely supported Brezhnev's plans to launch a Soviet space station. This was a respectable accomplishment that could reasonably be achieved quickly and with moderate resources. It also meant Ustinov was interested in advancing the launch of a Soviet space station so that the space program would not look so incompetent under his direction. In February 1970, Ustinov conspired to pass a government decree that would simultaneously speed up the launch of a space station while grievously harming Chelmy. The decree called for the launch of a new space station called the DOS-7K. DOS stood for Long Duration Orbital Station, and 7K was a reference to the Soyuz spacecraft that would be used to ferry cosmonauts there. This is the space station that would eventually become known as Salyut. Under the decree, the DOS-7K was to be developed under the direction of Vasily Mishin. To speed up development, Mishin was to use one of the Almaz spacecraft constructed by Chelmy's engineers. Mishin was to fill out the Almaz with existing and available instrumentation made for the Soyuz spacecraft. In this way, by taking the Almaz space station chassis and the Soyuz equipment, Ustinov was able to accelerate the launch of a space station and cut Chelmy off from his one and only connection to a Soviet manned spaceflight program. One of the great ironies of Ustinov's arrangement is that both Vasily Mishin and Vladimir Chelmy thought it was a terrible idea. Chelmy's position was obvious. He thought it was a terrible idea because he wanted to keep the Almaz. But Mishen also thought it was a terrible idea because he thought the construction of a space station was a waste of time. Mishen wanted to focus on completing the legacy of his mentor and friend, Korolev, by landing a Soviet cosmonaut on the moon. He considered the space station program to be a distraction and would have preferred that the program stay with Chelmy. Under intense political pressure to respond to Apollo, however, this was not an assignment that could be refused. So, by mashing up the chassis from the Almaz and the instrumentation from Soyuz, the first DOS space station was delivered to Tururutam for launch in March 1971, just 1 year after the decree. In the rush to build the space station, however, the checkout process revealed numerous mistakes during assembly. Many of the instruments had to be removed entirely and reinstalled, so it was not actually ready for launch for another month. Before launch, the DOS space station had originally been given the name Zarya, meaning dawn. But just before launch, the Soviets learned that China was using the same name for one of its satellites. So Mishen decided at the last minute to change the name to Salyut, as a salute to the 10th anniversary of Yuri Gagarin's journey into space in April 1961. There was no time, however, to change the name Zarya already inscribed on the space station itself. So, at launch, the space station still carried the name Zarya. On April 19, 1971, a UR-500 rocket boosted the space station into an orbit of over 200 kilometers. After launch, however, the Soviets learned of a significant failure. One of the key compartments on Salyut contained a telescope. A shield on the outside of the space station covering and protecting the telescope during launch had failed to jettison as planned, threatening to seriously hamper the scientific value of the space station. There were also problems with two of the 8 ventilation units used for life support on the space station, but this issue was not considered as serious. With Salyut now in orbit, the Soviet Union needed to send a crew to man the space station. 3 cosmonauts had already been selected for this mission. They were Vladimir Shatilov, Alexei Ilyasyev, and Nikolay Rukavishnikov. Shatilov, as the commander of the mission, was now one of the Soviet Union's most experienced cosmonauts. He had flown on Soyuz 4, which conducted the first docking with 2 crewed spacecraft with Soyuz 5 in January 1969. He had also flown on Soyuz 8 and was the overall commander of that odd Troika flight with Soyuz 6, 7, and 8. Ilyasyev was similarly a veteran, having flown on Soyuz 5, the spacecraft that Shatilov docked with, and on Soyuz 8 alongside Shatilov. For Rukavishnikov, this would be his first time in space. On April 23, 1971, 4 days after putting Salyut 1 into orbit, the Soviet Union launched Soyuz 10, with Shatilov, Ilyasyev, and Rukavishnikov aboard. By the time Soyuz 10 got into orbit, the condition of Salyut was already deteriorating. Efforts to remotely jettison the cover on the telescope compartment had failed, And now, 6 of the 8 ventilation units needed for life support had failed. The problems only continued, however. Soyuz 10 managed to maneuver itself into the same orbit as Salyut and rendezvoused the following day. But Shatilov was unable to dock with Salyut. He managed to maneuver Soyuz 10 into the Salyut docking port for a soft docking, but he could not get the docking system to accept a hard docking. Sensors showed that there was still a 9-centimeter gap between the spacecraft and the space station. Shatilov tried to forcefully close the gap by firing the Soyuz 10 engine, but that did not work. He then undocked and tried to redock several times, but nothing helped. Soyuz 10 then encountered serious problems when they could not undock from Salyut after making a soft docking. The lives of the Soyuz 10 cosmonauts were not in immediate danger. They could always detach the docking apparatus and return home using the descent compartment of Soyuz 10. The docking apparatus is always jettisoned before re-entry anyways. But this left the prospect of a docking apparatus stuck in the Salyut's one and only docking port, making the space station useless in the future. Eventually, Shatilov was able to undock Soyuz 10. And at this point, ground control reassessed the situation. Soyuz 10 had used up a considerable amount of fuel attempting to dock. And if they continued trying, they could have another situation where Soyuz 10 could not undock. So the decision was made to abandon the docking effort. Instead, Soyuz 10 was to fly around the space station and take photographs of the docking node to allow engineers to figure out what went wrong after the mission. On April 25th, Soyuz 10 returned home, having failed the primary objective. But the Soviet Union hid the failure, claiming publicly that entry into the space station was never part of the mission. The subsequent investigation revealed that the docking apparatus had been damaged during the attempt to dock. Vasily Mishin immediately put together plans for follow-up missions, with another attempt at delivering a crew in July 1971. Initially, Mishin proposed launching only 2 cosmonauts so that they could carry pressure suits with them. This would allow for an EVA to both remove the cover on the telescope compartment and examine the damage on the docking apparatus. This idea was ultimately dropped because the pressure suits were not yet ready, a problem that will come back to haunt the Soviet space program because of the tragedy that is about to follow. The next attempt to crew the Salyut would be done by the crew of Soyuz 11, which the Soviet Union now aimed to launch in June 1971, just 2 months after Soyuz 10. To fully understand the story of the Soyuz 11 crew, I need to back up a bit because the crew selection for Soyuz 11 is going to be important. The Soviet Union prepared for manned missions by assigning a prime crew, a backup crew, and later they also started assigning a tertiary crew. This was similar to NASA, which had a prime crew and a backup crew. And while I haven't discussed this before, starting with the Apollo program, NASA also had a tertiary crew that was generally significantly less experienced than the prime or backup crews and were responsible mainly for the administrative side of the mission preparations. The Soviet Union had a similar model, with a prime crew with experienced cosmonauts training for the mission, a backup crew also containing some experienced cosmonauts, and a tertiary crew that was rather green. Because of the need to quickly prepare for the Soyuz 11 mission shortly after the failure of Soyuz 10, the prime crew selected for Soyuz 11 was actually the backup crew for Soyuz 10. Since Soyuz 11's mission was basically going to be the same thing as Soyuz 10's mission, it made sense to just use the backup crew given the need to quickly prepare for Soyuz 11. This also meant that the tertiary crew for Soyuz 10 was now also moved up and was the backup crew for Soyuz 11. The prime crew selected for Soyuz 11, which again was the backup crew for Soyuz 10, included Alexei Leonov, Valery Kubasov, and Peter Kalodin. Leonov was the man who conducted the first spacewalk during Vashod 2. Kubasov also had some experience in space, having flown on Soyuz 6 as part of the Troika flight. Kalodin was the only one in the group who had not been to space. Shortly before the launch of Soyuz 11, however, flight surgeons noticed that one of Kubasov's lungs was swelling. They suspected that he had tuberculosis. As a result, Kubasov was grounded. And pursuant to mission rules, the grounding of Kubasov meant the entire prime crew would be removed from the mission in favor of the backup crew, since each crew trained together. This was a situation eerily similar to the one faced by the prime and backup crews for Apollo 13. Remember that Charlie Duke on the backup crew had the measles and exposed Ken Mattingly on the prime crew to that disease. The only reason that NASA did not swap out the entire prime crew for the backup crew on Apollo 13 was because there was one member of the prime crew and one member of the backup crew that were both grounded, meaning either crew would have to be broken up to launch on time. In the case of Soyuz 11, however, there was no issue with the backup crew. So now the backup crew became the new prime crew. The new crew for Soyuz 11 now consisted of Georgi Dobrovsky, Vladislav Volkov, and Viktor Patsayev. This crew had significantly less experience. Of the three men, only Volkov had any experience in space, and that was on Soyuz 7 as part of the Troika flight. The crew had significantly less experience because they were originally the tertiary crew for Soyuz 10. Making matters worse, they had received the least training out of any of the crews. The crew itself had only formed about 4 months earlier, in February 1971, and they had no expectation of actually going to space. Ready or not, however, on June 6, 1971, the Soviet Union launched Soyuz 11 with Dobrovolsky, Volkov, and Patsayev aboard. This time, Soyuz 11 successfully made it to the Salyut station and docked. The Soviet Union had finally delivered a crew to a space station in Earth orbit. The crew would stay on the space station for 24 days, setting a new endurance record for time in space. For the 3.5 weeks they were in space, They provided regular reports and television updates that kept public attention. For the first time since Apollo 11, and even before that, the Soviet Union could claim a genuinely meaningful advance in space over the United States. Hidden from public view, however, was the fact that the mission was an extremely nerve-wracking one for the relatively inexperienced cosmonauts. The problems began as soon as they arrived. Upon opening the hatch from Soyuz 11 to enter Salyut, the cosmonauts smelled burning. As a result, the cosmonauts actually spent their first night inside Soyuz 11 rather than the space station, fearing that something was wrong. By the next morning, however, the smell had disappeared, and the cosmonauts began activating the space station's instruments. But then, on June 16th, 10 days into the mission, the problem recurred. Once again, the cosmonauts smelled smoke inside Salyut, and they quickly evacuated the space station back into Soyuz 11. After switching the space station's power to the backup electrical supply and turning on the air purifiers, they were able to return to the space station. The stay on Salyut also became increasingly uncomfortable over time. Part of this was due to personality clashes between the cosmonauts. But the cosmonauts also had problems maintaining their health. They had to exercise to avoid having their muscles atrophy, but they found that using the exercise equipment on Salyut caused the solar panels to shake in a disturbing fashion. They also tried to use the spacesuits designed to bear weight to allow them to exercise, but they found that the spacesuits kept tearing. They also had a vacuum suit that they could use to shift blood around their bodies, but it didn't really work. As a result, Mission Control decided to end the mission early after 24 days. The original hope had been to keep the cosmonauts on Salyut for a full 30 days. On June 29th, 1971, the crew returned to Soyuz 11 to prepare for re-entry. But there was a problem when they closed the hatch between the spacecraft and the space station. An indicator light showed that the hatch was not fully closed. They tried reclosing the hatch a few times, but each time the indicator light stayed on. Finally, concluding that it must be a problem with the sensor, the cosmonauts simply put a piece of paper over the sensor to block it before closing the hatch, forcing the indicator light to turn off. Soyuz 11 then undocked from Salyut, and the spacecraft began the automated sequence of events for re-entry. As part of the automated re-entry sequence, explosive bolts jettisoned the work compartment and the service module compartment, leaving only the descent compartment of Soyuz 11. Shortly after the explosive bolts fired, ground control lost radio communication with the cosmonauts. This was unusual, as communications should have been possible for another 25 minutes or so, at least until the spacecraft started to enter the atmosphere. Ground control was able to continue tracking Soyuz 11 as it continued on its trajectory. Besides losing radio communication, everything else seemed fine. What they did not know was that the cosmonauts were already dead. Soyuz 11 continued on its path, and automated systems brought it down to a successful landing in Kazakhstan 23 days after launch. But when the recovery teams arrived, they found the hatch to the spacecraft was still closed. The cosmonauts had not gotten out. When they opened the hatch, they could finally see why. Inside were the lifeless bodies of Dobrovolsky, Volkov, and Batseyev. For some reason, none of the cosmonauts were strapped into their seats, as would have been expected for re-entry. An on-the-spot investigation immediately pointed to death by asphyxiation. A more thorough investigation later filled out what likely happened. Inside Soyuz 11, underneath the cosmonauts' seats, was a respiratory valve. Normally, the valve was to open after the spacecraft had successfully re-entered the atmosphere. In this case, it appeared that the valve had been shaken open by the explosive bolts that jettisoned the working compartment and the service module compartment for re-entry. At this time, Soyuz 11 was still 150 kilometers above Earth, in orbit. The opening of the valve caused air inside the cabin to start rushing out into space. The rushing air likely produced a whistling noise, and the cosmonauts all likely sensed the rapid drop in air cabin pressure. The investigators speculated that the cosmonauts tried to investigate the source of the whistling noise by turning off the radio, which would have been generating static. This would explain why ground control had lost radio communication with Soyuz 11 shortly after the explosive bolts fired. And it was confirmed by the fact that the radio inside Soyuz 11 had been turned off. There was nothing mechanically wrong with it. The cosmonauts must have also removed their straps to investigate the source of the noise. This would also explain why none of them were strapped in after Soyuz 11 landed. Dobrovolsky, Volkov, and Patseyev, however, never really had a chance. With the rapidly falling cabin pressure, the cosmonauts would likely have lost the capacity to work within just about 15 seconds. The cabin would have been at a near vacuum by 30 to 40 seconds, and they were all likely dead in less than 50 seconds after the valve opened. To this day, the deaths of Dobrovolsky, Volkov, and Patseyev remain the only human deaths to have occurred in space. The loss of the Soyuz 11 crew caused the Soviet Union to fall into mourning. The deaths were a significant blow at a time when the Soviet Union was just starting to prove that its space program was on par with the United States again. In the aftermath of Soyuz 11, the Soviet Union decided that their cosmonauts would no longer go to space without pressure suits being available to them. Up to now, they had been launching cosmonauts without pressure suits unless there was a planned EVA, because the development of the spacesuits were well behind schedule. Recall, this was why Mishin's proposal for a two-person mission for Soyuz 11 to allow for the inspection of the outside of the Salyut had not been possible. The Salyut space station itself would remain in orbit for only another 3 months. The Soviets remotely fired its engine 5 times to maintain orbit, but eventually it was clear that they would not be able to mount another crewed mission to Salyut in time to use it. Not after the deaths from Soyuz 11 and the need for investigation and pressure suits. Salyut eventually re-entered the atmosphere over the Pacific Ocean. And do you remember the prime crew for Soyuz 11 with Leonov, Kubasov, and Kalodin, whose lives had been saved only because doctors suspected Kubasov had tuberculosis? Turns out he just had an allergic reaction. Despite the failure of Soyuz 10 to dock, followed by the utter tragedy that was Soyuz 11, the Soviet Union maintained its focus on space stations as the nation's next major space goal. The Soviet Union was manufacturing more DOS space stations using the Almaz chassis. The hope was that they could take attention away from NASA's impending Apollo 16 and Apollo 17 missions in the following year in 1972. More about those missions next time.